Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special two-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
You're listening to Working, the podcast about what people do all day. I'm Jacob Brogan. This season on Working, we're talking to individuals whose jobs touch on aspects of LGBTQ life. As regular listeners of the show probably know, I did a PhD in English literature before I became a journalist and started hosting the show, among other things. And one of the people I wrote about in my dissertation was this remarkable queer science fiction novelist named Samuel R. Delaney. Delaney's books, Dahlgren, Nova, Trouble on Triton, Jewels of Apdor, and so many others are among the most remarkable explorations of desire and its limits in any genre. And I couldn't be more excited about this episode in which we sat down to chat with Samuel R. Delaney, who goes by the name Chip to his friends, about his writing process, about the way that his own particular desires have shaped his work, and even about the role that dyslexia plays in his writing, reading, and revising process. This is one of the episodes I'm happiest that I've gotten to do, and I'm so, so happy that I get to share it with you. Then, in a Slate Plus Extra, Samuel R. Delaney shares some recommended science fiction novels by other writers that he thinks anyone, whether you're a fan of the genre or not, should check out. If you're a member, enjoy bonus segments and interview transcripts from Working, plus other great podcast exclusives. Start your two-week free trial at slate.com/workingplus. What is your name and what do you do?
My name is Samuel Delaney. All my friends call me Chip, and I am a writer.
What kind of writer are you?
Most of what I write is science fiction. A lot of what I write is criticism and nonfiction. And I've written some other things, other kinds of fiction than science fiction. So I write generally all over. And I do a lot of Facebook posts.
So you've been writing science fiction since 19. You wrote your first book, Jewels of Apdor, at 19. You published that when you were 20.
Yeah.
You are 75 now?
75. Very close to 76.
Very close to 76. You've also written, as you suggest, memoirs, criticism.
Comic books.
You wrote two issues of Wonder Woman.
Mm-hmm.
You've written Sword and Sorcery Fantasy.
Yes.
Your Neverion Quartet.
Neverion.
Nivarian?
Nivarian.
I should have known that from the Diacriticals.
There you go. That's why I put them
Nivarian.
In.
Nivarian. That's the pleasure of radio. You get to hear the correct pronunciation. You've even written pornography that you,
yes.
I think, identify as
yes.
pornography. Given all of this, given the range of your work, is there a reason that you maybe primarily identify, in some cases, as a science fiction writer?
Well, yes, science fiction is probably where I have the largest reputation. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people think of me as a science fiction. I was elected a Damon Knight, Grand Master of Science Fiction 2 or 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm. The 30th Grand Master of Science Fiction.
Yeah, 30 or 31st, I don't remember. Mm-hmm. So
it's just what you've been doing.
Yeah, and as I said, and I was also a professor. I've been a professor at several universities. Mm-hmm. I first in 1975 at SUNY Buffalo. Then I kind of was mostly supporting myself as by writing, and then I went to at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst for 11 years, then for 2 years up at Buffalo again, and then since then at Temple University down here in Philadelphia.
But you're no longer teaching today?
The teaching is more or less over with.
Are you still writing today?
I have to write, and I have to travel around and do talks. You make more money talking about science fiction than you do writing it. In fact, I think you make more money talking about writing in general mm-hmm. than you do writing.
But you've also, I mean, you have published literally dozens of books over the course of your 55-odd year career.
Right, but not dozens of science fiction
books. Not dozens of science fiction books, but your most recent full-length book, Through the Valley of the Nest of Spiders.
A great big long one. It's that fat one with the black
800-some pages.
Four, but who's counting?
Four?
804 pages.
804 pages, okay.
But who's counting?
So that book came out in 2012. Are you still writing novels now, or is most of your writing, I mean, I know a lot of, you mentioned that you publish on Facebook, a lot of that is essayistic or memoiristic.
Short, very short.
Short writing.
Short writing, yeah.
Are you also still writing novels?
Novels? No, I have the two novels that were not published that I've kind of put together, and I'm curious whether I may be able to place them. Mm. And I have a collection of letters coming out with my university press when they will hopefully get around to publishing, mm-hmm. and another collection of essays that, again, I'm waiting for them to move forward with.
So this is a show about working, about the way we work. So I wonder, are you the kind of hyper-disciplined writer who writes 1,000 words every morning between 7 and 10 a.m., or do you have a more chaotic schedule?
It's chaotic. I try to do the writing pretty much first thing in the morning after I get some coffee and oatmeal.
Uh-huh.
That's the first. I get up. I go to the bathroom. I come out and I make some oatmeal, what have you. And sometimes I get to work even before the oatmeal is done. Mm-hmm. You know, if I've got something that's really on my head, those tend to be nonfiction of that sort. Facebook. Those are the Facebook posts.
Yeah. What about when in periods of your life when you are writing fiction? Science fiction or pornography or fantasy or whatever, whatever genre you're working in. Is your schedule different there than it is these days?
Well, it's changed every time I've moved to a new neighborhood. Now, mm-hmm. I've only been here for a few months now.
We're in your apartment in Philadelphia today.
Yeah, here. Yeah. Up until a couple of months ago, I was in at 1123 Spruce Street, which was another neighborhood, a different kind of neighborhood. Mm-hmm. A neighborhood was in Center City. It was much more, it was on Spruce Street. And it was much more lively. There were more, you know, I used to go and I would go and get a latte every morning mm-hmm. from the cafe on the corner, the Green Street Cafe. And I would usually try to take a picture of the first person I saw, you know, pass by mm-hmm. On the street and, you know, and post that. That would be part of my Facebook, you know, things.
Yeah.
There are nowhere near as many people on the street in this neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
This is just a much less populous place.
So you have your coffee here in the apartment then instead?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then do you work out of this apartment, or do you have a separate office that you
operate No. From? We are now in my office / living room.
Can you describe this space that you work into us a little bit?
Well, there's a wall of books behind there. Mm-hmm. And then there's another wall of books. And then there are some boxes over there that are left over from the move, which I stuff that I still haven't got unpacked. Mm-hmm. And this is my assistant over here.
Hello.
Bill.
Hi, Bill.
And he's the one who knows what buttons to push.
On the computer?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But do you work at the computer yourself?
Yeah, I can do, I mean, I can do some of my things. I can do my writing and what have you. But I'm very dyslexic and uh-huh. have been all my life, with the result that even the writing goes relatively slow, and I always have to go over and correct things again. So even the Facebook posts have to get rewritten, because I cannot type the word deer, without writing DEAER. Hmm. It there's always an extra E, mm-hmm. comes in, and then I have to take it out.
Yeah.
The dyslexia has been described. It's not a problem with your memory. It's a problem. It's pathological absent-mindedness, which is a very good, I think, description of it.
Yeah.
Because it you can't shake it. Some of it is habitual absent-mindedness, like the DEAER.
Uh-huh.
But
I wonder though if that pathological absent-mindedness has shaped your own writing practice, the obligation to go back over to review.
It made me aware, very much aware of style. Because I did, since everything had to be retyped and rewritten and at first when I was young, it was a matter of typing it three times. Then when you get to word, then you have to, when you get to word processors, there is no, just the whole notion of the discrete draft vanishes, mm-hmm. and you just rework things forever.
Do you?
It's not a new draft until somebody else has read it first. Yeah. then you've written another draft.
So you're, I assume, a pretty aggressive reviser.
Yes, I am. Then. Yeah, I revise. Mm-hmm. I don't write. I revise.
Yeah. I mean, you're known in your science fiction and in your other writing as a high stylist in many ways, and often an experimental one. Mm-hmm. Even in your more mainstream-ish science fiction, there are still stylistic and technical flourishes in terms of the way you organize chapters, but also even more granularly at the sort of syntactical level. How much of that kind of stylistic play that shows up in so much of your work comes through in those first drafts, and how much of it is a product of revision and rewriting?
I couldn't tell you. I mean, most of it. Mm. it varies per page. It varies. Sometimes I have to rewrite a paragraph 5, 10, 12 times. Sometimes one will come out more or less correct the first time, except for the odd misspelling. Mm-hmm. And if someone catches it, then it's fairly easy to correct.
Yeah.
Bill sits there, looks over my shoulder, and sort of points it, to the extra letter or where I've done something stupid. Mm-hmm. My emails have to be rewritten again and again and again. Mm-hmm. I used to say I can't sign my name to a check without rewriting it three times because I'm likely to misspell my own name. I actually do misspell my own name when I'm writing checks and things like that.
You're also, I assume, from looking around this room, but also from knowing your work, a pretty copious reader.
I was. I find it's harder and harder for me to read as I get older. Mm. It really is. That's another thing that's definitely changed with getting old. I don't feel that much like I've aged. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel if I, you know, if I sit back and just, I feel, you know, I feel like I felt like when I was 12 years old, you know. Mm. But I do know my voice sounds a little different. My voice sounds a little rougher to me than it sounded when I was 12.
Sounds very smooth to me.
Well, okay, but I can hear all the little, you know,
sure,
the little things that that are different about it. I did a lot of singing. Mm-hmm. I used to be in singing groups and things like
that. You were in a folk group as
right,
well.
Yes, at one point. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We were planning to record. I wrote a book about it.
Heavenly Breakfast.
Heavenly Breakfast. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm in touch with one of the members of the Heavenly Breakfast group who came to see me not too long ago, which was great. It was a guy named Bert Lee, which was really nice. And I went over with him to put him back on the train and what have you. Mm-hmm. And good guy, very 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 sweet young man.
So not to
although he's 60 something now, I think of him as a sweet young man because when I last because the time I saw him before that he was about 18 or 19. He's now just hit 60s.
So not to return too aggressively to the question of style and composition, but does that musical background, has it ever informed the way you write? Do you think of a kind of musicality in your own prose?
Right. Yes. I'm interested in what the sentence sounds like, its mm-hmm. rhythms and how they play, mm-hmm. you know, and play off with one another.
Yeah.
And I have my series of, you know, don't put too many, you know, don't watch out for those adverbs, you know, mm-hmm. If they're not doing something really important, get rid of them. Mm-hmm. The noun. I've written a book on writing. It's right behind you. It's called About Writing. It's directly behind your head.
See it.
Can you see it?
I saw it earlier. There it is.
There you go. Yeah. And there's a whole group of 10 things. You know, the noun can stand up to one adjective, you know, two at the most, you know, and or you have to be doing something really special, mm-hmm. you know, to use more. And things of that sort.
Yeah. So you're thinking about the spareness of style,
yeah,
mm-hmm. as well as a sort of experimental—I won't say excess, but
right.
extremism, mm-hmm. perhaps mm-hmm. That you can sometimes reach. One thing that you know, again, looking around this room, looking at the many books mm-hmm. In here,
this is about a quarter of my whole library that I lost. About a year ago.
Oh no! Sorry.
Yeah, one of the moving is because I had to give up and get rid of three quarters of my library. So this is just literally a fragment of what it once was.
Well, and to the extent that it is just a fragment of it, one thing that I really notice in this room, looking at the books that surround you as you write today, is their own variety, diversity, mm-hmm, so on. And here you have, you know, your own books mixed in with, you know, the comics of Linda Barry, the right. theory of Giorgio Agamben, the novels of Don DeLillo. Mm-hmm. Is that kind of
Roger Zelazny, the Theodore Sturgeon,
a lot of science, classic science fiction as
right,
well.
Yeah, not people, a lot, a little classic
a,
science.
A little classic science fiction.
Yeah,
comics of Chris Ware.
The poems of Robert Duncan.
Yeah, so I mean, there's this tremendous variety in here. For you as a writer, has it been important to literally and figuratively surround yourself with that kind of thematic, stylistic?
Yeah.
Generic diversity,
right? Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, I used to read the Barry Windsor Smith comics when they were coming out.
You know, when the Conan artist,
who was really extraordinary, Conan artist, mm-hmm. an extraordinary artist, and I liked that stuff very much.
Yeah. Well, I mean, given all of these forces that you're dealing with, all these ideas that are coming at you, all these ideas that are channeling through your work, I wonder though. Are you an outliner, or do you just dive into a story or an essay and write it as it comes?
I do some outlining and I do lots of rewriting, mm-hmm. as I said. And the outlining is part of the rewriting.
Mm-hmm.
I will outline something. I'll start writing it. I have an ideal form, which doesn't cover everything. And, you know, but where you start writing it, and when you're about halfway or a third of the way through, you see how close you're following the outline, and then whether you want to re-outline it, you know, and see if it's changed your way. And, you know, that's how I got through the Navarian series, which ended up being, 11 novels and short novels and shorts and a few short stories, and where the basic form of the science fictional / sword and sorcery story series is that the problem you write a piece, and the solution of piece A becomes the problem of piece B, and then which is not the progression of novel chapters. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's a very different form from the chapters in a novel.
Yeah, the stories, the novels that compose that collection. I'm going to say the name of it wrong.
Navarian.
Navarian.
So accent on the sentence.
Navarian.
Navarian on the second syllable.
So the novels and stories that compose this, we call quartet sometimes because it's composed.
Oh, it's 11.
Four books.
Return to Navarian is the title of the whole series, and the series is 11 stories in 11 stories and novellas and novelettes, which were simply divided more or less arbitrarily into four volumes. They could fit into four volumes. Yeah. The second volume is a complete novel.
Those stories, though, are themselves stylistically quite diverse. You talk about the solution of story A becoming the problem that motivates
story B,
and so on. There are characters that run through them. Gorgic the Liberator, this former slave. Gorgic, I'm sorry.
Hardgy.
Learning a lot about mispronouncing things that I've been reading for a decade today, and loving it. Gorgic the Liberator, who's this former slave turned kind of revolutionary figure over the course of the series. But also these other figures, a mummer, an actor who is a sort of Socrates stand-in.
Yeah, and it is no accident that one of the things you learn is that in this language, Gorgic, the term Gorgi is the slang term for the male penis.
Mm-hmm. And it's also, as you're suggesting, sort of ribald, sexual. And among other things, this series contains what is generally recognized to be the first American novel about AIDS, The Tale of Plagues and Carnivals, which is a remarkable story, book, novel, some of which takes place in our own New York in 1984, some of which takes place in this fantasy kingdom.
World, yes.
Naiwan, am I saying that one right? As it's undergoing a plague of its own, an AIDS-like plague of its own.
Navarian is, if you read it, it's never yon.
Right.
And if you put the accents on, it's never yon.
Across it, never.
Yeah, across, yeah.
But I guess what I'm getting at is the kind of problems that you are opening up in these stories are not the kind of problems that a casual, maybe we would even say careless reader of fantasy might associate with the genre. You're grappling in these books with, in some cases, pressing and immediate issues of the moment in which you wrote them.
Yeah, sure, yes. AIDS was going on. Margaret Heckler made her announcement of the discovery, quote, the discovery of the AIDS virus while I was writing the book. And there's an account of sitting there watching it on television in the book.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Over the decades, your work has grown increasingly explicit about preoccupations with sex and sexuality, especially around questions of the sort of experience of sexual minority, of queerness, of homosexuality. You've sometimes suggested that science fiction, maybe even fantasy, not maybe even fantasy, maybe fantasy as well, genre generally, may be especially amenable to these kind of themes, these questions of sexual and also probably racial minority, because it is itself kind of marginal genre.
Now put a big, great big negative sign in front of what you've just said and you'll make it correct.
All right. Tell me the correct thing.
Okay, the correct thing is that there is no there's nothing special about science fiction that makes it amenable to doing that.
Okay.
There's nothing special about it. It is simply a genre. So many of the people, so much of the science fiction that actually gets published is published by proto-fascists and historically has been.
That's right.
You know, they've been interesting fascists, and they've been less. Some of them have been somewhat less, somewhat more benign than you know some others. But basically, it's people like Heinlein and Jerry Purnell and what have you like that. We're really we're far right. You know,
This is a debate, as I learned recently, that dates back at least to the first world science fiction convention.
Yes, sure. Yeah. I mean, a lot of the people on the East Coast were very much on the left. They were very, when I say much on the left, I mean they were socialists, and they were, they grew out of things like the Young People's Socialist Alliance and the young things like that. And the people on the right coast were people who were very much on the right. And for many years, the most popular, the Heinleins and what have you, Heinlein and, even Bradbury, was a West Coast writer and basically one, nice guys. I talked with Heinlein once on the telephone when he was trying to solve, and he was a big deal. And he was trying to solve a political problem, and he was using the fact that he was kind of the biggest deal around to bring people together. And he made a suggestion, and I don't even remember what he was dealing with, but I know that it made sense after the phone call, so I went along with it. And people like Isaac Asimov were also, were very much on the, was very much a lefty.
Yeah. Well, he actually had a quite copious FBI file because of that.
Yes, exactly.
Let me ask that question a different way. You are black and gay. Your work deals explicitly and maybe increasingly so over the years with themes of race and questions of sexuality.
Yes.
Have you found science fiction to be a useful lens for thinking about those issues to the extent that you think about them in your work? Or is it just a sort of accident of the genre, the paraliterary form, to use a term that you've embraced in the past, that you've chosen to embrace?
Well, I think it does work. I mean, Theodore Sturgeon was a married gay man. Like I was married for a while, and I have a child. You know, I possibly Ted thought of himself as bisexual. I don't know. We never got a chance to ask him. I know that there are bisexuals out there. I have met people who just really are bisexual. I am not one, which is why I live with Dennis, today. That's kind of the way that sort of works. I write about those things because those are the things that fill up my life. That's why I'm interested in them. That's why I write about them. And I write about them as fiction too. Yeah. Although I do use a fair amount of observation as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, given the longstanding push and pull between left and right in science fiction fandom and among science fiction writers, have you received resistance from fans of your work as these themes grew more explicit in your prose, in your fiction, your your other writing over the decades?
What depends on what you mean by fans.
Good point.
I
said good point.
Which is to say that I've received hate mail. Mm-hmm. You know, I've received, you know, I mean, I can still remember when the third volume of the Neverian of Return to Neverian was published, Flight from Neverian. I remember getting a letter from some kid in Canada. I assume it was a kid because of the handwriting. And I opened it up, and there was this written in it, and it began, "Fuck you. You think you're so smart," and so forth and so on. And just went on from there about how awful he thought this stuff was. And it was because the stuff, you know, the stuff was about gay material. And obviously he was not, he had not picked up a sword and sorcery book planning to read about gay people.
A lot of those books, whether or not this young man realized it, were very gay.
They were, yes, I know. I mean, and certainly the Robert E. Howard, on which was the basis of the Sword and Sorcery stuff.
The original Conan series.
The original Conan series is as gay as, you know, it had, and in one sense, I was just taking what was I had already seen as there and bringing it to the surface, mm-hmm. you know, because it clearly, you know, it seemed to be already quite gay, you know, quite as gay as you could want. but they didn't want it. They didn't want it out there where everybody could see.
Yeah, you also have a sizable queer readership.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Today.
Yeah, and who are very happy with it. Very, very, very happy.
Yeah. But do they ever? I mean, what kind of relationship does that portion of your readership, do you think, have to the science fictional and fantastical?
Well, a certain percentage of one of the things that's happened is that the gay readers among fandom are much more out, as is everybody else today. I mean, you know, now it's, you know, same-sex marriage is the law of the land. We have not, my Dennis and I haven't been able to do that because up until fairly recently, Dennis had no photo ID. And we were only able to get that. He was only able to get that with Bill's help and my help and the help of a number of other people, many of them on Facebook. Or at least some of them on Facebook, a genealogist named Diantha Day Sprouse, who was instrumental in getting him his birth certificate, which he had never had before. But all of that, you know, which is one of the reasons I think Facebook has a place in all of this. Although I also know people who don't ever look at Facebook.
Yeah.
Apparently, Bill says the only time he looks at Facebook is when he's looking at my account to find out what mood I'm in this morning.
It's funny, you know, to think about a technology like that, or a subset of technology that has reshaped some of our lives so totally. For you, as a, you're not the kind of science fiction writer who was working or has worked in especially predictive terms for the most part. But what's your feeling about, how do you feel as a science fiction writer about having your life kind of reshaped around this different form of networking, of relations, of relationality?
The technology that we've got is too complicated, and so you get something like whether it was MySpace or whether it was Facebook or whether some of the others, you know, to sort of limit, you know, to come up with a platform that's easier to handle, you know, or just Gmail, you know, or something like that, because it makes things easier, you know, to deal with, and so that, which is to say do you do this on your iPhone or do you do it on a computer, my phone and that are
your
basically the same thing. You know, fundamentally they're the same thing. However, thumb typing is one thing, and typing with all five, ten fingers, you know, with eight fingers, and using the thumbs for the space bar is another thing. And so you need several different bodily technologies in order to make use of them. And that becomes, you know, and so the way the body interfaces with the actual object
Yeah.
is one of the things that one is always dealing with and always dependent on.
And it does seem like, not to return or to return to your work, it does seem like something, a peculiar and unusual way in which your science fiction often plays out, which is that it is, whether or not it's explicitly about queerness or what have you, it is work that is often about the body.
Yeah.
And its experiences. I think a lot when I read your work about the ways that you describe people's bodies, that the things that you're attentive to. One of the kind of personal predilections that shows up, I think, in a lot of your work is attention to nail-bitten fingers,
mm-hmm.
for example. Is it fair to say that your own desires, your own thinking about the body plays out in the way you write and the kind of things
absolutely.
You write about?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I have a sexual fetish for guys who bite their nails. I, mm-hmm. I'm usually safe in the same room with them. You know, I'm not, you know, although I, you know, but it does give, you know, and it's been there since I was 9 or 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would get on the bus before I knew I was sexual.
Mm-hmm.
It was this, you know, I was curious about my best friends in elementary school. Robert and Johnny and Michael Held and what have you were all the nail biters in the in the class. I didn't even know what it was in a sense. It had something to do, I think, with the fact that I had sexualized the hands and hands. My father had clubbed fingers and did not bite his nails, and it was something about coming up with something that made the hands very different from the from his.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a displacement of something. My father was not circumcised. I am. And so there was a just, you know, and so that's a, that was another thing that, you know, a sexual difference, that was important. I had the foreskin when it is forward on the penis looks a bit like the shape of a nail that has been bitten.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, there are all these things that are, you know, that have to do with it, you know, that connect with it.
Was there a moment when you said, I'm just going to write about this stuff, these personal desires, this personal attention to the body in my fiction? Was that a conscious choice for you?
Well, that's always what I wrote about. I mean, that was what I wrote about.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I started writing my masturbation fantasies down in a notebook,
mm-hmm.
Down in notebooks. And I, you know, and they were, my mother found them in the bottom of my underwear drawer, and took them to my therapist, who I was seeing a therapist and, you know, and I did not like my therapist at that time. I had a therapist whom I did not trust. I didn't like. He was I had very much liked the therapist. I'd first seen a woman named Dr. Green, who was and I liked her, and I thought she was going to be my therapist, and I was all ready for it. And then she just signed me to somebody else who smoked a cigar, which used to turn my stomach. And who was given to me specifically, and this is 1948 in a nutshell, because he was so masculine, and I was supposed to be, and I needed a model for masculinity. So that's what they would give. So basically, you know, not because he was a good therapist, because he smoked cigars and was, you know.
Nothing more masculine than sticking a big old cigar in your mouth.
Right. Absolutely. You know, and I'm still not too hot on, I like bears, you know, but I'm still not too terribly hot on cigars. In fact, I'm definitely not hot on cigars.
So you found your own way to masculinity.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Of a different kind, perhaps. Uh-huh. One advantage of science fiction, arguably, is that it allows us to imagine the world otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
When you were writing about this stuff, about your masturbatory fantasies, about the particularities of your desire, what have you, in science fictional forms, was there any conscious attempt there to think about a world that might be more amenable to your particular desires?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, who doesn't? I mean, I always assumed that probably Marx had some kind of fetish for workmen, which is why he wanted more of them in the world, you know, and for them to have a better, you know, have a better deal.
Yeah.
You know, because he thought they were, you know, at the very least good-looking people, you know, and or you know, or good, basically good people.
So we all write maybe about what we want.
Yes, exactly. Yeah,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Your work, though, I mean, if it is allowing you to imagine a more desirable world, it's not typically utopian. Mm-hmm. These are not. I think you did once use the word pornotopia to describe one of your works.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And you've also used the term heterotopia, yeah. A concept that comes from Foucault, suggesting a place of difference.
A place of difference. And it is also a medical term, mm-hmm. you know, that has to do with moving flesh from one part of the body to the other.
Yeah.
So that a sex change, for instance, yeah. is a heterotopia.
And in fact, in the novel that I'm referring to, Trouble on Triton, that is a science fiction novel that deals with
a sex change. Sex changes, yes.
Yeah. You know, does any of this stuff, this need to imagine these kind of alternate configurations of the world, has it grown less urgent for you as the world has changed?
For me personally, possibly. I think it's gone much more urgent for the rest of the world. I mean, which is to say we're in a really strange state right now. Mm-hmm. And we you know, the future does not look terribly good.
No.
You know, anything from global warming to I just posted seconds before you went in, to before you got here, three articles on the possibility of worldwide famine because mm-hmm. of what's going on in, you know, everything from the I just found a new term for it, insectagon, where the fall and the huge fall in the number of insects. So mm-hmm. the pollution is the pollination pollution. Well, there's the pollution problem, and then there's the pollination problem. Mm-hmm. Are getting out of hand. You know,
yeah.
the animal farming and the rage for meat is not going to be, you know, is not doing well mm-hmm. for the environment at all, you know, because it's making it harder and harder to grow vegetables, and vegetables basically right now are what we need.
Do you think of this kind of, maybe this is too aggressive a word, but this kind of doomsaying as a sort of science fiction, or is it just fact now?
Well, I don't know whether it is just leftover chiliastic panic. You know, which is to say, around the turn of the century, you know, there's always, and we just came into a new century a mere 17 years ago, mm-hmm. And we still may be, you know, we may have 20 years of just general, or we may be doomed. You know, we don't know. I'm 75. I don't know what's going to happen, and you know. I hope I last another, you know, 5-10 years. I have good genes in the family. I have a number of plus 100+100-year-old-plus relatives. I can remember thinking that I wasn't probably not going to be here too much after, you know, too much after 60. Hmm. You know, and suddenly here I am 75, and possibly, you know, and possibly will be a little while. The last first cousin that I had, the oldest first cousin that I had, who was 96 male, just died a couple of months ago. Hmm. So, you know, that's maybe I'll make that. I don't know. You know, I don't have no idea what sort of mental state he was in. I think he tended to drink too much, even at 96. The picture they had of him posted on Facebook, he was clutching a bottle of Jack Daniels, which is interesting because one of the last pieces of gay porn I watched was a very good-looking young man sitting on a bottle of Jack Daniels, as it were.
You really mean sitting on?
Sitting on, yes, and taking it up his butt.
Yes.
and he was, you know, and he, you know, where is it? It's, I believe that's the one.
To the Last Man.
To the Last Man, yes.
If you need the title.
If you yes. Yeah. It's in two volumes.
Do you, I mean, you've written pornography.
Yes.
Do you take inspiration from watching porn from looking at other people's fantasies?
Although I'm not I've always been much more involved in reading than and porn in general doesn't really. I went for a period where I bought a lot of it. Mm. I've had this for 8 years.
This movie, To the Last Man,
and just got around to watching it last night.
Was it worth it?
It was sort of, oh, that's what it's about. I do not know whether I will ever go back to it again.
You talk about writing on ecological themes now. You've also written some, I think just yesterday, you posted a memoiristic reflection that kind of had you returning to the scenes of some other earlier memoiristic writing that you've done. Do you see yourself writing more science fiction as you move ahead?
I don't know. My last short story, which is over there next to Through the Valley of the Nest of Spiders, which came out in the magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, is a science fiction story. My next book that's coming out is not science fiction at all. It's something called The Atheist in the Attic. And it's a reconstruction of a conversation between Leibniz and Spinoza back in 1776, I think. Mm. 1676. No, 1776 was our, 1676.
Does philosophy play an important role in your reading and writing life?
It has in the past. Yes, I was a philosophy reader, I read a lot of Quine and Derrida. Mm-hmm. Those were philosophers that I and a number of others as well.
Your work, even your
and Spinoza. I went through a whole big Spinoza. Through the Valley of the Nest of Spiders is the philosopher of the book is Spinoza. Mm-hmm.
And in your other fictional writing as well, you often cite, sometimes unexpectedly, post-structuralist thinkers like Carol Jacobs, who was a teacher of mine.
Carol Jacobs was a, say that again?
She was a teacher of mine, and I believe a high school friend of yours.
Yes, and she was, I was going to say, I was a friend with Carol in high school.
Yeah.
Isn't it a small world? Yes. She and Henry, her husband.
Henry Sussman, yeah.
Yeah, Henry Sussman got sort of helped me get one of my first job. Was it my first? They were there at SUNY Buffalo when I got there.
Yeah,
and it was really nice.
So you've always been a reader of philosophy and academic theory.
Mm-hmm. One of the reasons I got hired is because I had read all the academic theory at a point when the only people who were reading it were the people at Yale, because that was the center of academic theory.
Yeah.
But you went to an ordinary English department in an ordinary college, and they didn't know who all these people were.
We're talking about the mid-70s now,
before the
French theory made its way in force over the United States in the early 80s. So you are a longtime reader of this work. You've taught it, I think. Mm-hmm.
Yes, I have.
And you've certainly written critically about it. But do you see your fiction as theoretical or philosophical in its approach, its method, its style?
Other people do. Mm. Other people do. I do have a. I just got some. Not that one, but there is some. I did get an award for philosophical fiction a few years ago, and I don't think I ever got the actual plaque for various reasons.
Would you put it up if you got it?
I probably would if I did get it. Yeah. I got this. That's an award. That clock over there is an award.
A very complicated clock.
Yes, a very complicated clock from Kalalu, which is an African American journal. Mm-hmm. I probably would.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're also you're listed on the editorial board of a publication called GLQ,
the boards don't mean anything.
Of course, right.
Yeah, right. They really, that's just your name.
Yes.
Yeah,
uh-huh. Well, so one of our recent guests, Elizabeth Freeman, was until I think just this month, actually, or just last month, the editor of GLQ for, for 6 or 7 years. Do you still, are you still steeped in that kind of academic discourse?
I do not keep up with it. I mean, I just don't. I don't, there are not enough hours in the day. And as I said, my reading in general has just become harder and harder for me. You know, I try to keep up with people like Stephen Shaviro and what have you. I'm much more likely to keep up with my friends. You know, what my friend try to read the stuff that my friends are doing, whoever they happen to be, than to keep up the way I did 25 or 30 years ago when I would read every issue of Yale French Studies that, from one end to the other. And with the result is that I made some friends, you know, from doing that, you know, Jane Gallup and people like that.
Yeah. Important critics, all of them. So, I'm gonna, to return to a kind of practical question, you said earlier that you can make more money talking about science fiction in some cases than writing about it. If I may ask, how do you make money today for the most part? I mean, a few of your books were pretty significant bestsellers in their time. Dahlgren sold over 1 million copies, and I'm sure still sells reasonably well for a book of its age. Other works of yours have more cult status. The vast majority are still in print, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which makes me feel very lucky.
Yeah, but do you make money from your writing, if I can ask a sort of impolitic question?
No, I make some money for, I have the same agent I had when I was 23. Some people, I'm a faithful guy. Mm-hmm. You know, I tend to hold on to, if I lock on to someone and I like them, I try to stay with them. With the result, as I said, I wonder how my agent is going, who is a year older than I am. What, you know, he's seven, you know, he's still going. I don't know how strong he is going. I assume he is, but we people on this side of 70, you know, are often do things like die, if for instance I get a call at some point and I, you know, when I hear that, you know, Henry is no longer with us, my, you know, I have no idea. I'm not sure what I'm going to do, you know, and getting used to a new age. Henry himself makes most of his money from films these days. I don't even know how many literary clients he has. He produced the Bourne Identity films and things like that. That's where he makes a lot of his money. I asked him, I said, why do you keep me on, Henry? And he said, well, you give the place style. No, I'm sorry. He said, you give the place class is what he said. Not even style.
Do you feel that way about your work? Do you class up the joint?
No, I don't think so. No, I think I'm just there. About the worth of my own work, I cannot know and you cannot tell me, which is what it comes down to.
Yeah.
I have too many reasons to misunderstand you and you have too many reasons to just lie.
Sure.
for whatever good intention, you know, you want to make the old man feel good or whatever.
Let me ask this, looking back on this 50 plus year career, are you proud of the work that you've done?
I did as well as I did the things I could do as well as I possibly could do them. That's all I can say, you know. And I have no idea whether they are, you know, as I said, I have no idea whether they work or not, or whether they don't, you know. I have a few people who are very faithful readers I have 500 friends, but I only have 700 who follow me, you know, on Facebook. And of those 700 who followed me, sometimes I think it's only 12 who are really pay attention.
I didn't even know that I could follow you until recently.
Well, there you go.
Maybe follow Chip Delaney.
Yeah, well, that's just it. I mean, the new platforms have to be, you have to learn how to use those. Mm-hmm. And if you don't, if you don't know how to use them, you're screwed.
As a science fiction writer, do you ever feel that the future has gotten away from you?
I don't think I ever had it. I mean, I don't think I ever had the future. People tell me, people tell me that people tell me I'm the guy who invented the internet. That's a book of mine called Stars in My Pocket Like Grains of Sand. Has, you know, that every once in a while somebody says, oh, well, that's the book that invented the internet. You know, and that I don't know. I wasn't trying to. I was just writing about something that, you know, and whether it's at all true or whether it's just hyperbole never believe your own hype. Mm. You know, that's the way to get really screw yourself over.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us today.
You're most welcome.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Working. I'm Jacob Rogan. This week, we'd love to recommend that you check out Leon Neyfakh's amazing podcast, Slow Burn. The specter of Watergate haunts the Donald Trump presidency, but for all the parallels staring us in the face, election interference, possible obstruction of justice, the naming of a special prosecutor, those of us who didn't live through Richard Nixon's downfall have no idea what it was like to experience it. You can learn more about Slow Burn at slate.com/Watergate. Here at Working, we always love to hear from you by email. You can write to us via working@slate.com. You can also reach me on Twitter. I'm just, I think, Jacob Brogan. Pretty easy to find there. You can also listen to past episodes at slate.com/working. We want to give a special thanks to Aaron McGregor, who helped us record this episode, which I went to Philadelphia to do at Samuel Delaney's house. She also took some great pictures of Samuel Delaney. You can see one of them on Slate's website on the show page for this show. This episode was produced and edited by Benjamin Frisch.